นะโมตัสสะบะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะบะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะบะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนะมัสสามิ Okay, so it's sutta number 47 in the Majjhima Nikaya, known as the Vimangsaka Sutta, the inquirer. This word Vimangsaka is also used in the four Idipadas, the four roads to power, and it basically means like to inquire or to investigate. So this sutta goes as follows. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's grove, Anathapindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, they replied, and the Blessed One said this, Bhikkhus, a bhikkhu who is an inquirer, not knowing how to gauge another's mind, should make an investigation of the Tathagata in order to find out whether or not he is fully enlightened. Okay, so this straight away here we see that one of the first things he says here, if you don't know how to read somebody else's mind, gauge somebody else's mind, so if you do know how to gauge somebody else's mind, you can just go and read somebody's mind instead. So he's almost like inviting people to read his mind if they can do so. And the second thing actually recognize here is that he said that one is supposed to make an investigation of the Tathagata. It's a good thing to make an investigation. And this is, of course, interesting because the point here is that if you want to have a strong faith and a faith based on reason, and the more clear it is to you that somebody is fully enlightened like the Buddha, somebody actually has those qualities that they claim to have, the more clear that is to you, the more firm that faith is going to be. And the more based it's going to be on, if you like, reasonable assumptions. So it's actually important to investigate. And this idea of investigating people, of course, you can investigate the Buddha is one thing, but this should actually be taken much further than just investigating the Buddha. Investigation of this sort should be taken to anybody who you take as a teacher. And I sometimes you hear that, you hear things like, you can never really know for sure, so therefore you have to be careful with investigation. But when the Buddha says that it's good to investigate and that you should investigate, then I think that we can take it as reasonable that we actually investigating somebody and look at the qualities is actually something good and something positive that we always should be doing. So this is a first point I think is important here. Venerable Sir, our teachings are rooted in the Blessed One, guided by the Blessed One, have the Blessed One as their resort. It would be good if the Blessed One would explain the meaning of these words. Having heard it from the Blessed One, the bhikkhus will remember it. Then listen, bhikkhus, and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, Venerable Sir, the bhikkhus replied, and the Blessed One said this, Bhikkhus, a bhikkhu who is an inquirer, not knowing how to gauge another's mind, should investigate the Tathagata with respect to two kinds of states, states cognizable through the eye or through the ear. Thus, are they found in the Tathagata or not any defiled states cognizable through the eye or through the ear? When he investigates him, he comes to know. No defiled states cognizable through the eye or through the ear are found in the Tathagata. So the point here is obviously that if we are going to investigate somebody, there is really only two ways that we can do that investigation. We can either look at the person and see if they do things which look wrong, which are defiled, or we can listen to what they say, and we can see, do they say things which are clearly defiled? These are the two ways we can investigate, unless we can read somebody's mind directly, in which case we can bypass all these things. But there doesn't seem to be that many people who can do that. So we generally rely on these two things. And what sort of things can we expect to see when we look at somebody? What is the meaning of the defiled states here? And I think that the main defilement that we're talking about here is states of anger and maybe irritation and negativity here. Because this is one of the things which are most obvious in people. Greed can often be more difficult to see here. That also can be seen sometimes, but I think it's more difficult. I think sometimes it's more easy to see greed by the negative reaction that can come through greed, through your frustration of your desires. And when you get frustration of your desires, you obviously can get a bit angry and upset. So you can actually see the greed often more through anger. So I think anger and irritation is the most important one here. And greed and desire is like a secondary state. And of course, the point again, just to expand on what I said before, that if we see something like what looks like anger or looks like irritation in somebody, you should take that seriously. It is not something that should be explained away and said, well, you can't really know because this may just be a personal characteristic of somebody. It's not necessarily a defiled state. The Buddha said you can know. And when you see something like that, there is reason to be careful. The Buddha doesn't say that we should make any absolute judgment of certainty that, if somebody shows something that looks like anger or irritation, definitely they can't have attained anything, or they may be they haven't got anything at all. But the point is that these things we see on the external, they signify things which lie deeper within inside, usually. And at the very least, we should have some doubt and some questions if we see this sort of behavior in somebody. Particularly if we're going to take them as our teacher and maybe take them to be fully enlightened or close to enlightenment. When he comes to know this, he investigates him further. Are there found in the Tathagata or not any mixed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear? When he investigates him, he comes to know no mixed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear are found in the Tathagata. Okay. A mixed state is obviously a state which is somewhere neither completely pure nor completely impure. I think the commentary here says that if one is practicing, then sometimes one's conduct is pure, at other times it's not pure. So there's like a sequential there of different states. But I think that the meaning here quite likely is also that the actual mental state you have at any particular moment is a mixture of good and bad. So you may have a positive intention and maybe a slightly unwholesome motivation combined with it. Because the mind is so complex, you can have these kind of grayish kind of motivations. And this is what I suspect is the meaning here. So you investigate the Tathagata. Does he have any of these kind of gray intentions or gray actions which have a mixture of positive and negative to them? Okay, next paragraph 6. When he comes to know this, he investigates him further, thus, are there found in the Tathagata or not cleansed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear? When he investigates him, he comes to know cleansed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear are found in the Tathagata. So it's interesting here. One might perhaps think that once you have investigated and found that all the dark states, one has come to the conclusion that there is no defiled states or dark states in the Tathagata, you might think maybe, well, the conclusion must then be that he has cleansed states. But I think maybe the point here is that when somebody has gone a long way on the spiritual path, obviously you often find people with remarkable qualities. People who seem to have very strong mindfulness, a very strong presence of mind. People who have a lot of metta and compassion for other people. People who have happiness, which just seems unnatural for most ordinary people. And I think these are the things that we're looking for here, because this is also like one of the markers, in a sense, of somebody who is special, in the sense that they have these qualities in a much more powerful way than other people have. And I know that many people, like, you know, for example, take somebody like Adam Shah, for example, and many people say that it's just amazing to be in the presence of a person like that, because it has this incredible power to it. And you get the sense that there is a mind there which is very different from the mind of most people, very high degree of concentration, high degree of mindfulness, combined with compassion and loving kindness and all these qualities, which makes for a very unique individual. Again, these things are obviously also to some extent have to do with personality, but they always are enhanced by one's practice of the path. So somebody who's fully enlightened, you would expect them to be quite special in this sense as well. When he comes to know this, he investigates him further thus. Has this Venerable One attained this wholesome state over a long time, or did he attain it recently? When he investigates him, he comes to know this Venerable One has attained this wholesome state over a long time. He did not attain it only recently. So the first thing here is that I feel the translation is a bit strange. Having attained it over a long time. I better to translate this as he attained it a long time ago. That I think is a more accurate way of putting it. It makes more sense to me, at least. So the first thing is, so the question here is, did he attain this state a long time ago, or did he attain it only recently? And the meaning here of this having attained it a long time ago is perhaps not immediately apparent, but the meaning seems to be that we have been able to observe this person for a long time, because he attained this state a long time ago. So we have seen that he has these pure states, he lacks the defiled states, he lacks those mixed states, he doesn't have that. And it's not just a recent phenomenon, it's something which has been the case for a long period of time. We have observed this person for a long period of time. It's not just that one thinks that he attained this a long time ago. And it's interesting, the Chinese version of this sutta has precisely that. The Chinese version says that one has observed him or seen him for a long time. So that sort of seems to indicate that sort of understanding of this passage is the correct one. Now, why is it important that somebody should have had something for a long time? What is the point that is being made here? And the point is, of course, that if you know somebody for a short time, they might be able to suppress bad states over a short period of time. They might be able to sort of put up a front which looks very wholesome, very inspiring. But when you see something for a long time, then you know much more powerfully that there's a consistency there. There's something, a continuity in the purity of those states which makes it much more powerful then. You cannot fake something over the long term. This is really what this is about. And there is some very interesting suttas also in the Anguttara Nikaya. And they say that if you are going to decide on somebody whether they are virtuous, whether they are wise, whether they have whatever qualities they have, you have to stay with that person for a long period of time and observe them for a long period of time. Unless you have been there and observe them for a long period of time, you can't really be sure. So you have to be careful. You can't really come to a conclusion until you have seen the consistency over a long period of time. And not only that, in that sutta, the Buddha also says that you have to be wise yourself to be able to actually see these things. So to be able to uncover whether somebody else is virtuous or wise, you yourself have to be wiser. It's a bit of a catch-22, because we are hoping to get wise, and here we have to be wise in the first place to be able to see these things, which makes things a bit difficult. But of course, these wisdoms are relative. There is a little bit of wisdom, and then there's more wisdom. But you need some wisdom to be able to see this. And then, when you have observed a person for a long time, well, then you can tentatively conclude, at least, that, well, this person really seems to be virtuous. There seems to be some truth here to this. And this is important in how we deal with teachers, for example, how we deal with what we hear about other people. sometimes you hear about all kinds of monks who are supposed to be arahats and anagamis and sotapannas and have deep samadhi and all these things. And sometimes I ask the person, well, how long did you stay with this teacher? Why? How come you have this? How are you? Why are you saying that this person is definitely an anagami? And they say, oh, I stayed in the monastery for 2 weeks. And that's not enough, in my opinion, to really come to any firm decision about whether somebody has attained something or not. Or even 2 months, or even 6 months may not be enough. Sometimes you have to stay in a place for years and years and years to really be able to come to a firm conclusion about something. Yeah. So be careful about sometimes this hearsay, because often people say things a bit offhandedly without really having investigated the matter deeply enough to come to such a firm conclusion. So, and this is one of the reasons I like to stay around in the monastery for a long period of time. That's why I've stayed in Bodhinyana Monastery for now for almost 13 years. Because I feel that, you know, you should investigate a place properly before you come to any decision. And then when you have investigated properly and you feel confident with what you've got, well, then there's good reasons to stay on in that place. And I maybe can also add here that the problem often is also it's very difficult sometimes to actually know whether somebody is enlightened or not. You can hear many people might agree this person is definitely enlightened. Just because many people say so is not really a good grounds for actually believing anything. There are lots of people who believe all kinds of strange things in this world. So if the quantity of people, number of people believing something is to be used as a gauge for whether something is true, then you might as well believe all kinds of strange things. So this is not really the way. You have to, it's fair enough, if a lot of people believe something is enlightened, well, check it out for yourself. Maybe there's something to it if many people say so. But don't take it as something absolutely true until you have actually checked it for yourself. Only then does it make sense to look at these things. So you have like many criteria here for using, for deciding something, and that is what other people say about somebody, what they say themselves about themselves, and your own observations. And all of these things you have to take into account usually. And then you can start to make up your mind whether there's something there. Okay, I'll move on to the next passage here, number 8. When he comes to know this, he investigates him further thus. Has this venerable one acquired renown and attained fame, so that the dangers connected with renown and fame are found in him? For bhikkhus, as long as a bhikkhu has not acquired renown and attained fame, the dangers connected with renown and fame are not found in him, but when he has acquired renown and attained fame, those dangers are found in him. When he investigates him, he comes to know this venerable one has acquired renown and attained fame, but the dangers connected with renown and fame are not found in him. Okay, so this is just a small thing here about the way this is stated here. It says, the dangers are found in him. I personally think it's better to say the dangers exist for him, because the danger here are renown and fame, and of course those they exist in him. The dangers are not what happens afterwards. But anyway, it's a small matter, nothing much to make too much out of. The point here, of course, is that somebody may have a really good conduct when they are secluded. Somebody who has, for example, very good samadhi may be able to keep a mind free of defilements for a long period of time. In attaining samadhi, you can keep the mind very pure for long periods of time. But then, because the defilements haven't really been abandoned, then when certain things happen in your life that can kick those defilements, so to speak, to kick them back into being again, well, then the samadhi may no longer be strong enough to suppress those defilements. And renown and fame is known in Pali usually as labha sakara siloka. This is just slightly different phrasing here. This has usually a very powerful effect on people and can be very powerful in bringing up all kinds of defilements, such as pride, arrogance, conceit, desires of various kinds. So this is why this is particularly stated here, because somebody who may get a good reputation for being somebody special by his good meditation may then actually become defiled because of these things, and defilements may arise. So these are very, very important matters. And somebody who is able to not become proud, not to become arrogant or conceited when they become famous, well, that is somebody who obviously has their act together in a very good way. And then there is greater reason for actually having faith that their conduct is actually pure for the right reasons, that they actually have attained something deep and profound. It is interesting that this gain, honor, and fame, labha, sakara, siloka in the Pali, there is a whole section in the Samyutta Nikaya which talks about these things because they are so powerful and they can have such an insidious effect on the mind and really destroy so many good qualities that you might otherwise have. And this whole section in the Samyutta Nikaya basically says that, well, these things are very dangerous. And whenever they come up, particularly maybe if you are in a position where they tend to come up, such as you become a monk and you start to become really famous, like Ajahn Brahm might be in that position. And you have to be very careful because it really can influence your mind. It can really influence your defilements and bring up many bad defilements in you. So this is what this sutta says. And it says that particularly if you think you have gone a long way on the path, it may drag you down again very fast. One of the very famous stories in the suttas is the story of Devadatta. And Devadatta was famous for, among other things, that he was very highly praised by kings and things like that. Ajatasattu, who was the king of Magadha at that time, he became a disciple of Devadatta. And Devadatta got so much praise, so much fame, so much honor, that he succumbed to that. Even though he was very highly attained beforehand, he had very deep samadhi, had psychic powers, all that, he succumbed to that fame and honor. And he declined after that until the point where he challenged the Buddha to become the leader of the Sangha. So he really made some serious errors of judgment there, to say the least. And he, for that reason, and that was only because of these kind of problems, becoming famous and renowned. There was actually one thing I wanted to point out, which I forgot to point out just before here. In the previous paragraph we just did, where it talks about whether he attained his enlightenment or whatever it is here, recently or a long time ago, you may notice there that that paragraph says, has this Venerable One attained? It says the Venerable One. In the previous one it says, are they found in the Tathagata? And I don't know whether they're exactly what the reason for this is. There might be a natural reason, but it looks a bit strange. And I suspect that one explanation for this changeover might simply be that there has been an insertion at this point in the sutta, that originally these may have been two different suttas, or one part here may have belonged to a different sutta, and then it was inserted in this sutta because the subject matter was obviously so closely related that somebody felt that this should actually be one sutta. And you see these things happening sometimes. You see suttas being conglomerated and added to and being prolonged in this way. It's not completely unknown. And often it comes out, in particular, when you compare the suttas across different traditions. For example, you compare the Chinese recension with the Pali recension or some Sanskrit sutta fragments with the Pali, you can actually see these things. So, although I'm far from sure, that is one possible way of describing why there is that change there. Okay, so move on to the next paragraph, paragraph 9 in this in the translation here. When he comes to know this, he investigates him further thus. Is this Venerable One restrained without fear, not restrained by fear? And does he avoid indulging in sensual pleasures because he is without lust through the destruction of lust? When he investigates him, he comes to know This venerable one is restrained without fear, not restrained by fear, and he avoids indulging in sensual pleasures because he is without lust through the destruction of lust. So here we have being restrained from fear here. Basically means that you think that you have maybe a reputation you think you have to keep up. You think that other people think that surely this monkey really got something special, so I have to keep up that reputation. So you are afraid that maybe your reputation or the way people look at you is going to be negative unless you keep a very strict control of yourself. So you control yourself out of some sort of fear that somebody might look upon you in a negative way. And of course, the opposite is if you are restrained without fear. Your restraint is natural. It comes because you have cut off those defilements completely. The defilements aren't there anymore. So your restraint comes because of that naturalness inside of you. And that, of course, is the ideal way of doing it. And the restraining, these things, I presume, are something sort of maybe difficult to see. But I guess with careful observation, this is the sort of thing you might actually be able to see as well, whether somebody is restrained through fear or not. And this actually comes up in the next paragraph. And again, the same thing, is he indulging in sensual pleasure because he is without lust through the destruction of lust? This, of course, is a continuation of the other one. If you just don't indulge because you haven't destroyed lust yet, well, there is going to be some tension there in you. There might even be a sense of fear, which is the reason behind that. So when he investigates this, he comes to the conclusion that he is not restrained by fear and that he does not indulge in sensual pleasure because he is without lust through the destruction of lust. Now, bhikkhus, if others should ask that bhikkhu thus, what are the Venerable One's reasons? What is his evidence whereby he says that Venerable One is restrained without fear, not restrained by fear, and he avoids indulging in sensual pleasures because he is without lust through the destruction of lust? In other words, why are you saying this? Answering rightly, that bhikkhu should answer thus. Whether that Venerable One dwells in the Sangha or alone, while some there are well-behaved, and some are ill-behaved, and some there teach a group, while some here are seen concerned about material things, and some are unsullied by material things, still that Venerable One does not despise anyone because of that. Okay, I'm going to retranslate that, but because I think that translation is not too easy to understand, nor maybe too good. So, answering rightly, that bhikkhu would answer thus. That Venerable One is just the same whether he dwells in the Sangha or alone. That is the first phrase there. And the point here, of course, is that if you restrain yourself through fear, through the sense that you have to prove something to other people, that you're afraid of showing yourself who you actually are, if that is the reason you restrain yourself, then once you go back to your own kuti, and there's no fear anymore that anybody's going to see you, you will tend to live in a different way from when you live in public, right? So your conduct is not consistent. There is like a sense of lack of integrity there between the way you are in private and the way you are in public. So that is why if somebody really is the same both in private and in public, then you can assume that he is not actually restrained out of fear, but it is a natural restraint. He's either practicing naturally, or he has destroyed those defilements. The latter part there is about while some there, etc. I've rewritten as follows. He does not despise anyone, whether they are well-behaved or ill-behaved, whether they teach a group, or whether they are concerned or not about material things, or concerned about or unsullied by material things. So again here, if somebody is restrained by fear and you have to force your restraint when it comes to sensuality and sensual pleasures, if that is forced, then you will tend to despise other people who don't restrain themselves. That's just natural consequence of things. I can see that sometimes even in myself, that you can see that if, for example, in the monastery, we all have to abide by certain rules. If somebody doesn't abide by a particular rule, whether they just forget it or whatever the reason might be, sometimes you can get a bit upset. You think, wow, we all have to live by these rules. They should also do that. You can see how the mind works. And this is exactly the same thing here. You see that if somebody else doesn't restrain themselves, whereas you do, sometimes it can give rise to defilements in the mind, to a bit of ill will and negativity towards that person. But when you don't despise anybody, whatever they do, whether they behave badly or they behave well, if you don't have that despising, that is usually a sign that you are not concerned anymore, because you have found your happiness through the complete destruction of those defilements. So whatever other people do, that's really their problem. And you may want to teach them to help them out, but whether they follow those teachings or not, it's not your problem. And the same thing goes here about whether you are concerned about or unsullied by material things. Basically, if you are pure yourself, you are no longer going to get upset whether somebody else or despise them because they do things which are bad, because they have sensuality or they have lust and all these things. It doesn't matter anymore. You have gone beyond all that sort of stuff. Okay, so then it goes on page 417. So now he has given his reasons why he considers this particular monk not to be restrained by fear. And now he gives a second reason coming up now. And I have heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. I am restrained without fear, not restrained by fear. And I avoid indulging in sensual pleasures because I am without lust through the destruction of lust. So again, it is one's own observation combined with what other people say, which often are the most powerful way of deciding whether somebody has attained something or not. The Tathagata bhikkhus should be questioned further about that thus. So far, we have been through the investigation aspect, and now we come to the point where, okay, you have investigated, you feel confident that the Buddha doesn't have these qualities, or whatever monk you're investigating, or nun, or layperson, whoever it is you're investigating, you feel confident that they haven't got these qualities. So now you actually go up to the person and ask them directly, have you got these qualities? And if they are honest, and usually people will be honest about these things, particularly monks, because if you're dishonest, you can fall into parajika offense and no longer be a monk. So obviously you really want to be honest about these things. So because people are honest, even if you haven't seen something which might exist in that person, when you ask them, they might tell you, actually, I've still got some defilements left, such and such. So that's what's happening here. So he questions the Buddha and he says, are there found in the Tathagata or not any defiled states cognizable through the eye or through the ear? And the Tathagata would answer thus, no defiled states cognizable through the eye or through the ear are found in the Tathagata. It's a little bit strange here why they use cognizable through the eye or through the ear, because you're actually asking the Buddha here. And it's really irrelevant whether it's cognizable through the eye or through the ear. You're asking him whether he has any defiled states. And again, this is interesting to note maybe why that particular phrase is in there. And I suspect it is in there because you have to remember the suttas are an oral transmission. And in oral transmission, usually you have like standard paragraphs, because it's much easier to remember standard paragraphs. So because the previous paragraphs had defiled through the ear and through the eye, it's very likely that this paragraph has been influenced by the previous paragraph, so as to ease memorization. Either that, or this paragraph has been influenced later on, not to ease memorization, but has been influenced simply because somebody has remembered it as being the same as the previous one. That's one of those things which apparently happen when you memorize things. You tend to make it uniform. Please, if you have any questions, please stop me at any time and ask, because otherwise you might forget it later on. Huh? Okay, so now we go on through the same possibilities we had before. So we have now asked about whether he has any defiled state. The next one is about mixed states. If asked, are there found in the Tathagata or not any mixed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear? The Tathagata would answer thus, no mixed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear are found in the Tathagata. If asked, are they found in the Tathagata or not cleansed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear? The Tathagata would answer thus, cleansed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear are found in the Tathagata. They are my pathway and my domain, yet I do not identify with them. Okay, so this last paragraph here is a little bit interesting. He's saying that cleansed states are the pathway and the domain. In fact, the Pali actually says, I am that pathway, I am that domain. It doesn't actually have the my, it doesn't have the sense of ownership. It has just the I am, ahang asmi, I am that pathway, the domain. So basically what this means, in my understanding, is that I have, like, these states have become part of me. This is not something I choose anymore to be kind or good in these things. This is like me now. I have become these things. And morality has become part, an integral part of the Buddha. It's not something you can divorce. Say Buddha is one thing and morality is something else. It's like, it's the same thing. Morality is an integral part, integral aspect of what the Buddha actually is. So that is basically what it means here, just to summarize what pathway and domain is. And of course, it's not just morality which is has become part of the Buddha, like part of the psychological makeup, if you like, of the Buddha. It's also liberation, concentration, entire Eightfold Path is part and parcel of the Buddha. You can't distinguish these things anymore, because the Buddha has almost like become these qualities. It's like if you develop loving-kindness and mindfulness long enough, they become so much part of you that you cannot get divorced from these things anymore. And that's what happened with the Buddha. Yet, I do not identify with them. In other words, even though they have become part of the Buddha, at the same time, because the Buddha has discovered the truth of anatta, it's not as if he says, this is me. He says, these qualities are there, they exist within these five khandhas, but there's nobody there to claim them as qualities which belong to me. They are just like natural phenomena in the world. Mindfulness and these things are natural phenomena. And these natural phenomena are found within the five aggregates when you follow a certain process, a procedure, called the Noble Eightfold Path. So there's no identity anymore with these factors. They just exist as a natural expression of who the Buddha is. Bhikkhus, a disciple should approach the teacher who speaks thus in order to hear the Dhamma. The teacher teaches him the Dhamma with its higher and higher levels, with its more and more sublime levels, with its dark and bright counterparts. As the teacher teaches the Dhamma to a bhikkhu in this way, through direct knowledge of a certain teaching here in that Dhamma, the bhikkhu comes to a conclusion about the teachings. He places confidence in the teacher thus, the Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good way. Okay, so at the beginning here, it says that the teacher teaches the Dhamma with its higher and higher levels, with its more and more sublime levels. Well, this is just a way, as I understand it, of talking about the gradual training. The higher and higher levels are as you improve your mind, you lift your mind up through mindfulness and then through the powerful states of concentration and samadhi, etc. You lift your mind up through higher and higher levels, more and more sublime levels, until you become eventually fully enlightened. So this is just a way of talking about the Eightfold Path and how it affects the mind. With its dark and bright counterparts. Okay, I I'm not 100% sure what this refers to. According to the commentary, it refers to kamma and vipaka. So I'm not sure exactly. So the kamma, the dark kamma has dark counterpart, and bright kamma has bright counterpart. Or dark kamma excludes bright kamma, and bright kamma excludes dark kamma. But I think it also may just simply refer to that if you do an action which is dark, then the bright counterpart of that action is like the opposite action. So if you, for example, telling lies, the opposite of telling lies is the counterpart of telling lies is truthfulness. One excludes the other. One is opposed to the other one. Or the counterpart to harsh speech is gentle speech. One excludes the other. They are counterparts to each other. Bright and dark counterparts. So if you practice one, you are excluding the other. This is my guess what the meaning is here. And then it says that when you teach the Dhamma to a bhikkhu in this way, then eventually that monk attains direct knowledge of a certain teaching here in that Dhamma. And that monk comes to a conclusion about the teachings. So here, it's interesting here that he says he attains direct knowledge of a certain teaching. Well, you have to remember here that the point that is made here, as I understand it, is that there are many different ways to teach the Dhamma in Buddhism. And particularly in the suttas, you see things like you can teach Dhamma as in the terms of the five aggregates. You can teach in terms of the six sense bases. You can teach like the six elements. And all of these ways are different ways of contemplating the Dhamma, of gaining insight into the Dhamma. And you can gain the same insight into the Dhamma through these things, but you use one of those teachings as a gateway to attain that insight. So because you only use one teaching, that is what is meant here by a certain Dhamma. You use that certain teaching to attain something. It doesn't mean that you have any less understanding of the noble truths or any less understanding of the liberation or anything like that. It just means that you have been focusing on one particular aspect to gain that liberation. And then he comes to the conclusion. He places confidence in the teacher. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practiced in the good way. At this point, you have seen the Dhamma that the Buddha taught. And because you know that the Buddha who taught these teachings, the only way he could have taught these teachings was by having realized them for himself in the first place. If he hadn't realized those teachings, then how could he have taught these teachings so well? So you know at this point, because you have seen what the Buddha was teaching you, exactly the same thing. The only way that the Buddha could have taught those things was if he knew them himself. The point, of course, is that nobody else does teach these teachings. The Buddha is really the only one. Other people would only be able to teach these things if they also became Buddhas. So if you had two Buddhas, maybe, then it would be the case. So that is how you come to that conclusion. You know that the Buddha must be enlightened because he started this whole thing called the Dhamma, and he wouldn't have been able to start it unless he had realized these teachings himself. The Dhamma is well proclaimed. It's well proclaimed because it leads to the results the Buddha is talking about. And obviously this monk knows that by now, that it leads to those results, because he has attained them himself. And the Sangha is practicing the good way because it is also practicing that same teaching which leads to the same results. Now, if others should ask that bhikkhu thus, what are the Venerable One's reason? What is his evidence whereby he says, the Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, the Sangha is practicing the good way? Answering rightly, that bhikkhu would answer thus, "Here, friends, I approached the Blessed One in order to hear the Dhamma. The Blessed One taught me the Dhamma with its higher and higher levels, with its more and more sublime levels, with its dark and bright counterparts. As the Blessed One taught me the Dhamma in this way, through direct knowledge of a certain teaching here in that Dhamma, I came to a conclusion about the teachings. I place confidence in the teacher. Thus, the Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good way. So it is the realization that you gain from following those teachings which gives you that confidence. And it is interesting here that all of these things, we are talking about now the inquirer, right? It's somebody who inquires into the teachings. And it's interesting that inquiry starts with looking at somebody and looking at them, have they got these qualities or not? Then it goes to asking them, have you got these qualities? And then the inquirer also moves on to actually doing the practice himself. Because only when you do the practice yourself can you really come to the final conclusion that these teachings actually work. So part of your inquiry should be to practice those teachings, because only then can you find out whether they really work. And only then can you come to an ultimate conclusion, absolute certain conclusion, yes, the Buddha is enlightened. Before that, you can think, very likely so, this monk looks very inspiring, but you can never be 100% sure. But when you see it for yourself, only then can you be 100% sure. So the practice of the path is part of the inquiry. So in a sense, it's like it's almost like a scientific experiment here, that you are going to test an hypothesis. You believe enlightenment is possible because you have seen somebody inspiring and they have the qualities that are very inspiring. And then you say, okay, well, let me really find out whether it's the case. And then when you test that hypothesis by practicing the same path and you come to the final conclusion, well, then you know with absolute certainty. So this is part of the inquiry, is the practice, and to see what happens when you practice these teachings. Bhikkhus, when anyone's faith has been planted, rooted, and established in the Tathagata through these reasons, terms, and phrases, his faith is said to be supported by reasons rooted in vision, firm. It is invincible by any recluse or Brahmin or God or Mara or Brahma or by anyone in the world. That is how, because there is an investigation of the Tathagata in accordance with the Dhamma, and that is how the Tathagata is well investigated in accordance with the Dhamma. So, in other words, when you reach this state of having actually seen things for yourself, then it can be said that your reasons are rooted in vision. Vision here means like seeing, right? Seeing for yourself. In the Pali Suttas, the word dasana, seeing, is always a word which is used for understanding and knowledge, deep insight. So vision here means deep insight of the Sotapanna, at least, to have seen this to be true. And when you do see this properly, then you become invincible, in the sense that you nobody can really shake you from that conviction anymore. Nobody can come up to you and say, well listen, this, you know, you haven't really got it. And it doesn't matter who it is, whether it is gods or some of the highest beings in the universe, anyone can come to you. But because you have seen it for yourself, you are unshakable, invincible. And this is one of the qualities of somebody who has seen the Dhamma, that they cannot be shook anymore. Nobody can shake them up. They are absolutely firm in what they have seen. And they cannot sort of tremble or become be afraid because somebody else is arguing with them. That is impossible for the Sotapanna. So, it is in this way, by practicing them in accordance to the teaching and taking it to its full limit, and seeing the Dhamma for yourself, that is how you complete this investigation and take it to its final limit. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that is a fairly short sutta, but it's amazing how much actually you can find in a short sutta like that. There's so much information that you can almost pull it apart indefinitely and talk about so many different points. Does anybody have any questions about this sutta? Yes, sir. Tathagata, okay. It's very difficult to know what the meaning is. Exactly, because it doesn't really have any particular meaning. It's just a word for the Buddha, basically. Yeah? And I think the commentary gives something like, is it four or six different meanings to the word? And I can't remember them all because I basically wasn't that interested in those things. But essentially, the two most important meanings is tatta usually has the meaning of thus in Pali, thus or so. And the last one, gatta or agata, means either come or gone. So one meaning is that he has thus come or thus gone. So it's like a slightly kind of, almost like a bit mystical term that was used in those days in Buddhism to explain somebody who was special or something like that. It was thus gone, thus come. It can also have the meaning, which is interesting, is tatta can also have the sense of truth in Pali. So it can mean the one who has come to truth. That's another possibility of that word. There's many, many, many possible meanings, but essentially at the end of the day, those meanings are not so important. The important point with that word is that it relates to the Buddha. Whenever you see that word, I'm not sure if it actually means the Buddha in all circumstances. Sometimes it may actually even be used for fully enlightened monks. I can't remember that. But generally speaking, it is a reference to Buddhas, basically. Anybody else has any questions they want to ask? Nothing more? Okay, maybe this... John? So, okay. Well, I think that the point here is that you can... Well, one thing is if you can read the mind, that's one way of doing it. That's one possibility. Another one is that you can probably, even though somebody is alone... You might actually catch a glimpse of him or see him a little bit or be in the vicinity. And you might see that maybe somebody, when they are supposed to be away, supposed to be alone, they may be behaving a little bit differently. But generally speaking, it is true. It's obviously much more difficult to know what they are when they are alone. But for example, take a monastery, for example. It might be the case that somebody who stays in the monastery, when he stays with the monks, he's mostly in his community, mostly by himself, but he may come out with the sangha occasionally, or he comes here to the Lamara, for example, or goes out with the lay people somewhere else, wherever that might be, and then maybe the behavior is different in those two cases, for example, and the fellow monks might be able to see that at least. No. Sometimes it's subtle observation. It's amazing what you can see sometimes with subtle observations if you observe carefully. Okay. Yes, the back there. No, I think that it is. I think the reason is because basically the Buddha always says that inquiry is a good thing. In Buddhism, discussion of the Dhamma, for example, is a good thing. Asking questions is always considered a good thing. You read the suttas, you see the monks asking questions all the time. And so it is reasonable in Buddhism when you find somebody who is a new teacher for yourself. It is a good thing to actually investigate the qualities in that teacher rather than be too quick in accepting things on faith. And this is just the Buddha saying to the monks, well, I claim to be fully enlightened, but why are you believing me? Should you really believe me? And he's saying that, well, if you investigate me, actually, maybe your faith will become more strong if you investigate me, because you are using your own powers of reason, because you are actually investigating properly, you're thinking for yourself. If you can see for yourself that what I say is true, then your faith will become more powerful. And there are lots of people out there who by nature are skeptical. if people go around saying, I am fully enlightened, is it right to just believe them offhand? There are many crazy people who say these things. If you go to psychiatric hospitals, you find people saying, I'm Jesus Christ, I'm the Buddha. I've heard people on telephone saying these things. So obviously you have to be, and even somebody might actually believe it. They might believe they're fully enlightened, and yet they might not be fully enlightened, you see. There is a sutta where the Buddha is asked, when monks or nuns or people come up to you and they declare to you that I am fully enlightened, is it the case or is it not the case when they do this? Is it true or not true? And the Buddha says, of course, sometimes it's true, sometimes it's not. So people overestimate themselves. And this is very common. This is very can very, very easily happen that people overestimate themselves. And the reason is because some of the states that you attain as you're approaching Nibbana are so profound and so powerful, people think, surely this must be enlightenment because it's so profound. So the point here is just that the Buddha says, well, you know, it's good to investigate because you shouldn't be too gullible. You shouldn't accept things too easily. If you accept things too easily, you will probably get let down. You place your faith in somebody very powerful there, and it turns out they're not as good as you thought they were. Well, you might get let down very, very badly here. I know people who have lost so much faith also in Buddhism because they have been let down by teachers. And the reason is they didn't investigate careful enough in the first place. So investigation is important. Don't put too much faith straight away. Because suddenly one day you get really disgusted if you read bad about it, what happened there. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. So it is, that makes it difficult. That's actually a very good point. I think this may actually be a teaching that the Buddha gave to the monks, because among monks you can actually talk about these things. So for lay people it is more difficult. So you are basically, you are a bit more left up to your own devices. But, you know, if you listen to people talk, the way people often speak, you can pick up a lot by the way people talk about things, you know. So you can, if you listen carefully, you will hear, they may not say things outright, but the way they speak is going to say a lot about the things that they at least think they have attained themselves. You know what I mean? You know, people, because obviously if you have certain experiences, well, you will tend to talk around that, even though we may not mention it directly, you will tend to talk around it. And because of that, you will, I mean, somebody who talks about the jhanas all the time, well, they are very likely to have the jhanas themselves. If you teach the jhanas, it's much more natural to teach the jhanas if you have them yourself than if you don't have them. And the more detail and the better they can explain them and all these things, obviously the more chance there is that you have attained these things. Or the same thing with status of enlightenment. If you explain these things in a convincing and natural way, then of course there is a good chance that you have experienced these things yourself. So you have to be a bit more roundabout maybe in that case. So that is that's a good point. Yes, Ainsley. Yes. Okay. Okay. I think the Buddha also said that the Dhamma is beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, beautiful in the end. So everything is really higher in one sense. But I think the point is just here that you are, as you're progressing, you're going higher and higher. It doesn't mean that there's anything low. It just means that you're going higher and higher all the time. You're moving upwards. I think that is the point here. But sometimes you have like a distinction between Abhidhamma and Dhamma. Abhidhamma is like, Abhidhamma has come to mean a particular part of the Pitaka, called the Abhidhamma Pitaka. But in the old days, at the time of the suttas, it didn't mean that. It meant something else. It meant, some scholars, nobody really knows sure exactly what it meant. But some people say it meant that which has to do with the Dhamma or concerned with the Dhamma, for example. So, but the word Abhidhamma in those days had actually a different meaning than it has now. But essentially, I would say all of these things, if you practice correctly, do things right, they're all good. They're all high states. The low states are the ones where you are immoral, or you do bad things. That is the low states. Does that answer your question? Or? Okay, right, yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. That's true. I people often say that. I must admit, I find it really depends, you know. I think it's fair enough. If you don't want to investigate something, it's okay. You don't have to investigate. Some people have a lot of faith, and maybe that's why he says in the beginning of the sutta that for a monk who likes to investigate, or for a nun or whatever, for them, they should investigate. But if you don't like to investigate, of course, you can't force people either to investigate. If you just want to practice, then that's fine. So if you want to say that's beyond me, that's okay, you know. And sometimes it's good to be a bit humble as well, because some of these things are very profound. And you can't really expect to understand it fully, at least, until you got there. On the other hand, I always found that personally that study was very useful. And the reason I felt that study was useful is that because only when I really had a good, comprehensive knowledge of the Dhamma, and I could sort of fit all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together, only then did I really feel I could start practicing properly. Because I felt, well, now I understand why I have to be virtuous. Now I understand why I have to meditate, because everything fits together nicely. So there is that aspect as well. Okay, so maybe we shall pay our respects to the Triple Gem.